This was raised up on a dais approached by three semicircular steps. He smiled at me in a manner which was meant to be engaging, but of course I could see the hatred and suspicion which was in his heart. That is one of the strangest things in that strange land. We still endeavor to deceive each other, and even think we can, although we know that others cannot really deceive us. We see the thoughts of others, and though our reason tells us that similarly others can see ours, yet some instinct still drives us on to attempt to deceive all with whom we come in contact. The emperor spoke, "Friend, you have already achieved much, seeing how short a time you have been in hell." I bowed. "Your majesty has spoken truly, and I hope to achieve even more. Even my throne," he murmured. "But I assure you, you will not find it an easy seat. Still, that time has not arrived, and will not. Come, let us be friends, you and I. We will be like David and Jonathan, and between us we will extend the dominions over which I now rule. If needs be, like Antony and Octavius, we can later fight over the spoils as to who shall own them. For the present, like those wise generals, let us unite our forces and compel the neighboring princes to acknowledge our dominion. Behold, I will make you my general, and you shall begin your career by attacking an upstart fellow called Danton who has terrorized an area near the confines of this city. It formerly belonged to another prince, but this fellow descended into hell with a large following and carved out this petty kingdom for himself. It is known as Paris of the Revolution. I saw quite plainly what was his real object. He feared to openly cross swords with me, yet felt that my constant presence near him, and yet independent of him, was a danger. He foresaw that by this means he would at any rate get me away from the heart of his empire for a time, and he, further, hoped that one of three things would result: either that I should be defeated and then made a prisoner by Danton, or that the struggle would result in a draw, whereupon he could intervene and crush us both. Failing either of these, he still considered the third alternative advantageous. This was that I should crush Danton and seize his precarious throne. In that case he believed that I should be fully engaged in retaining control over my new subjects, and so be unable to hurt him. He, on his part, would merely have exchanged one enemy for another, and might even find me so weakened by the conflict that he could attack and crush me easily. But though I saw his real intentions, yet it suited me to agree. I, too, feared open struggle with the emperor. I knew only too well what failure would mean. On the other hand, I felt confident that I should be able to overthrow Danton, and, having added his adherents to mine, return and attack the emperor with a far greater likelihood of success. "I accept with alacrity your majesty's gracious offer," I cried. Thereupon the emperor ordered a great feast to be prepared, and bade all the court attend. At this feast I was the honored guest. Wonderful dishes containing all manner of dainties were laid before us, but when we strove to eat them, feeling ravenously hungry and thirsty, there was nothing. The feast of Tantalus was no figment of the poet's brain, but a grim reality. Yet though it was a hollow sham, the wretched guests were compelled to pretend to enjoy the feast because the emperor demanded it. He, however, scorning to keep up the pretense which he compelled others to maintain, sat there with a sardonic smile upon his features. I, too, refused to play the game, and watched with grim amusement the efforts of the others to appear gay. Everything was but a hollow pretense. There was a large orchestra playing during the feast, but, despite their efforts, they were quite unable to produce any real harmony. It was simply a horrible discord, made all the worse by the fact that the audience were compelled to pretend they enjoyed it. After the feast the tables were removed, and gladiators fought before the emperor. After a while, female gladiators took their places, and these fought with a ferocity and devilish cruelty which exceeded even that of the men. I will not give in detail all the amusements which graced the emperor's feast, it will serve no useful purpose. Enough to say that they included every imaginable form of cruelty and lust, and that many of them were perpetrated upon the guests themselves. Chapter 10, The Attack on Danton. Soon after we had left the feast, I sent out some of my retainers to issue a proclamation calling for volunteers. This brought in a considerable number, and, having mustered these, I commenced a route march through the city towards the district over which Dan Don was supreme. As we marched, thousands flocked to our standards, and at length, reaching an open space which looked like a piece of waste ground, such as one used to see in and near great cities, I halted them and began to divide them into squadrons and companies. Such a motley crowd, men of all ages and times, were gathered there, ancient Roman gladiators, crusaders and robber barons of the Middle Ages, Chinese pirates, English buccaneers, soldiers of fortune from every corner of the earth, Turks, Bulgars. There they stood and yelled in wild excitement, shouting to be led against the enemy. At times they varied this by fighting among themselves. Gradually I sorted them into divisions, and placed these under officers. Thus I grouped the medieval knights into two huge masses and divided each mass into regiments and companies. Similarly, I organized the gladiators, the buccaneers, and, indeed, all these various constituents, and produced in the end a very serviceable army. Its great fault was an almost utter lack of discipline, but this was replaced by the dominating will of the officers I had appointed. Of course, these were constantly conspiring against me, and I had to be always prepared to crush a mutiny first in one part of the army and then in the other. Nevertheless, my will being, as you know, a remarkably strong one, I was able to dominate and lead this large force numbering over a quarter of a million. We proceeded on our way, the troops acting, as they went, in the most approved style of the worst kind of soldiery, that is, they broke into the houses as they passed, plundering and ill-treating the inhabitants. One peculiar fact which I noted was that they seemed unable to retain possession of what they had stolen. Once they had got it, it ceased to interest them and was thrown aside almost directly. When we reached the confines of the district held by Danton, I sent forward a scouting party, who soon returned, dragging several men with them. These wore the costume in vogue at the time of the revolution, and from them I gathered a great deal of information. Of course, they tried to deceive me, but as I could see their thoughts, it failed, as it always does here in the spirit world. These people are those who lived during the revolution in France. Some of them were the supporters of Danton, others were his opponents. Their chief amusement is the guillotine. But since the object of that was to produce a quick and comparatively painless death, they have slightly altered the procedure of an execution. Of course, there is no death in hell, and their object is to inflict as much pain as possible. They therefore place the victim on a board and slide that board under the guillotine, the man's feet, instead of his head, being in front and towards the crowd. The blade rises and falls a dozen times or more and cuts the victim in slices. The man suffers pain similar to that which he would have felt on earth, but the severed parts keep reuniting. He thus suffers over and over again all the agonies of death, but without the helping hand of that great benefactor who, on earth, puts some limit to the pain man can endure. How seldom is it that men realize how much more death is a friend than an enemy. How often have I longed for death again to come since that day on which he really came. The people in this district also reenact, so far as they can, the chief episodes in the worst period of the revolution. In particular, they hold blasphemous parodies of religious services, as they did then, and continually repeat the famous festival of reason, bowing down in mock solemnity before the original prostitute who on earth received their plaudits. Having obtained this and more information, I drew up my plan of campaign and then advanced into the enemy's country. As we did so, we endeavored to do as much damage as possible to the houses and people we met. While we tortured and made slaves of the latter, we endeavored to utterly destroy the former. We were able to do this so long as we were near the forms of the buildings, but as soon as we moved on to some other area and ceased to be interested, the buildings reappeared. Like ourselves, they are forms and so indestructible, they merely seem to disappear, because our wills are stronger than those of the owners, for the time being, but as soon as the stronger person's will alters, or as soon as it ceases to think about them, they resume their original shape. It is similar to the fact that the emperor can compel people to assume the forms of animals. In like manner we compelled these forms to vanish, but as soon as the will that had made them vanish was withdrawn, They resumed their normal shape. We thus advanced rapidly into the enemy's country, and ere long saw the enemy's forces mustered along a ridge. I should explain that there was some open country between the city in which the emperor reigned and Paris of the Revolution. It was not really extensive, but was sufficient to act as a barrier between the two spheres of influence. It was created and retained by the determined will of Danton, or otherwise it would have soon been covered with houses. It is utterly impossible to give you even approximate measurements, as space in your sense does not exist. However, it was large enough to enable two great armies to carry out all the complicated evolutions needed in a battle. The ground itself was the most dreary waste it is possible to imagine. It was black and burnt up, and, as it were, covered with ashes. There were two ranges of hills, and Danton had taken up his position on the further, while we occupied the ridge nearest to the emperor's city. Overhead, as it always is in hell, the air was black and the atmosphere dense as with a fog. We were, however, by now able to perceive each other in spite of the fact that there was no light. I grouped my heavy guns in three main divisions, A. W. Guns. Do you mean to say you have artillery in hell? The officer. Certainly. Where do you suppose the forms of all the weapons of destruction which men are forever inventing go, if not to hell? There is no place for them in the realm of half-belief, and they must go somewhere. Well, they come to hell. Now, the really interesting feature about the matter lies in this. Men who on earth have never used rifles or, indeed, any modern weapons, are almost entirely unable to use them. These weapons are forms and the pain which they inflict in hell is mental. It appears very similar to physical pain, for that is the easiest way for us to appreciate it. A man who on earth knew nothing of the effects of a rifle wound would here find it next to impossible to imagine it. He could certainly not impose that kind of pain on another, and he would not be easily susceptible to it as imagined by another. A man who on earth has heard how a bullet hurts will be able to impose that type of suffering on another, or realize it when another tries to impose it on him. But the man who can both inflict and suffer most keenly such pain is the man who has on earth actually undergone that particular kind of torment. Hence it comes about that often the most fiendish torturers here are those who were tortured on earth. If they die unforgiving, they are enabled by the very pains they have suffered to retaliate on their old oppressors to a most appalling degree. Is this matter quite plain? W. Yes, I think so. A parallel case on earth is to be found in hypnotism. I gather that a hypnotist can make his patient suffer sensations and pains according as he wills it. He can make him taste a piece of lemon placed not in his own but in the hypnotist's mouth. So, too, he can impose pain, especially pain associated with the nerves, and, contrariwise, can take away the pain which the patient is really feeling. The officer. Precisely, it is of course the same power, but it can only be used on the earth plane to a limited extent, because matter interferes. Still, by careful study and practice much more might be done on those lines than is. I should add, this power can be used both to help and to harm others. Many of the ceremonies of black magic are based on this principle. Thus, the wax doll with pins driven into the spot where the lungs should be was merely utilized as a means by which the magician could concentrate his mind on that of his enemy, and then cause him to suffer the same pain as he had pretended to inflict on the wax doll. It was, of course, easier to cause the pain by producing disturbances in the mental, or, at any rate, the nervous system. Still, there have been a few men of transcendent willpower who were able to affect matter direct, for at its highest mind is, of course, more powerful than matter. Such cases are rare on the earth plane, but become more general on this plane. You will thus realize that each body of troops employed those weapons which were familiar to it, and in like manner, for the most part, those who knew nothing of shot and shell were unhurt by them. The latter rule was not so absolute as the former. For a few men of exceptional willpower were able to inflict this type of pain of which they knew upon some of the weaker willed among those who did not. They were, however, comparatively few. Though we had cannon, we had no horses, for horses are animals with each a separate soul, and not forms only, like inanimate objects. The difficulty was partly surmounted by my compelling a large number of spirits to assume the form of horses, some to draw the cannon, others to act as mounts for the cavalry. I was here copying the Emperor's methods, and found it a most useful move, as it did not occur to Danton. I believe, moreover, his willpower was not sufficient to enforce such a command to any considerable extent. There are few things the spirits in hell hate more than being obliged to lose, even temporarily, their original form. To their materialistic minds it seems as if they are losing their identity. Chapter 11, A Battle in Hell. Then the battle began in real earnest. Compared to it, the fighting in the arena had been the innocent make-believe of children. Nearly all these men had been used to fighting all their lives. The battle, to a casual observer, would have appeared much like a battle on Earth, save for the curious blend of all kinds of weapons and costumes. The armor-clad knights charged again and again, and were met by solid phalanxes of Republicans armed for the most part with scythes. Danton was quite wily enough to know that against men who knew nothing of shot and shell these modern methods of destruction would be comparatively harmless. His scythe-armed rabble, on the other hand, would have been useless against our rifles, for most of them did know something of the pain which a bullet can inflict. Many, indeed, had been shot at various times, though the majority had fallen before the guillotine. Their scythes, on the other hand, were just the sort of weapon with which to meet horsemen. The Roman gladiators rushed forward in a solid phalanx to meet a regiment who charged up the hill with bayonets fixed. The enemy's artillery answered our own, but, being almost exclusively of the date of the Revolution, was not as effective as some of our guns. In this, indeed, was alike the strength and the weakness of Danton's army. It was much more coherent, and was kept together not merely by his dominating will, but by a sympathy of interests and history, and of course my force lacked these useful adjuncts. On the other hand, he was unable to employ any of the more modern weapons of destruction, while I could. So the battle raged for what seemed years. The plain between the two ranges was covered with what appeared to be wounded and dying men, and the screams of anguish rose even above the roar of the guns. I should add that the flame which leapt out every time a gun was fired was visible, but yet produced no light, that is, nothing which illuminated the surrounding darkness. But my forces not only outnumbered Danton's, but, on the whole, exceeded them in ferocity, and at length I was able to force back his left wing and then drive him from his position into the plain. Here his army was caught between my triumphant right wing, now occupying their former position on the ridge, and the remainder of my army, which still held the range nearest the Emperor's city. Here they were completely shattered, and such as could attempted escape down the valley to our left, the other three sides being closed. This plan shows you the final position. He sketched out roughly, as it were with fire, the following plan. See PDF version. The number of our prisoners was enormous, for very few succeeded in escaping to our left. My first act was to compel a large number of them to assume the shape of horses, and so release my own men. I did this not out of consideration for my own men, but because I thus was enabled to make it to the interest of my men to concentrate their will on keeping them prisoners. We then hurled ourselves upon the town and stormed it. I should have told you that quite a considerable proportion of Danton's army consisted of women, and these fought with even greater ferocity than the men. Consequently, when they fell into the hands of my victorious troops, the tortures they inflicted on these women beggar description. We, of course, sacked Paris of the Revolution as completely and thoroughly as it was possible for the most savage soldiery to do. We spared the inhabitants no suffering which could be devised. Yet, strange to say, whereas on earth there is some strange satisfaction to savage men in a sack, here there was none. It was all a hollow sham. The goods we plundered were useless to us, the wine we tried to drink made no impression on our ghostly gullets, the whole thing was a fraud. There was not even the satisfaction one gets in a dream, when one appears to taste the food one eats, and so forth. Even in our dreams we are still in touch with our physical bodies, and so can supply the full and proper interpretation. In hell, though we can still suffer pain, yet we cannot enjoy pleasure. That is the first great law in hell. If I could use the word law in a place which is essentially the negation of all law. I then set to work to establish myself on my new throne. I was surprised to find, however, that I had lost a considerable number of Danton's former subjects. I did not know it at the time, but I learned afterwards that the overthrow of Danton had enabled some who had been growing weary of the sort of life they led to hope faintly for something better, and this once done, help was vouchsafed them to escape and begin the first steps towards progress. Thus out of the appalling nightmare of that battle arose the possibility of progress for a few. Such is often the case in hell, showing how wonderfully out of evil God is able even that to bring forth good. Now I think you have heard enough, and this will form a convenient place at which to close my narrative for the time being. H. J. L. then spoke. Yes, I think, Jack, it is time you were returning. Then I sank into unconsciousness. J. W. Chapter 12, A Second Visit to the Emperor. H. J. L. had hardly ceased greeting me when the officer entered the room. He began almost at once. Having established myself in my kingdom, I soon began to realize the terrors of kingship. Never for a single moment could I feel at peace. Rest there was none. Ever I had to be on the watch to suppress some revolt or defeat some ingenious plot. I felt like a hunted animal at bay, surrounded by a lot of snapping curs who were only watching for their chance when I was off my guard. Every diabolical cruelty I could devise I employed to terrorize my enemies, but it was of no avail. I could not kill them, and the only effect of my tortures was that they hated me the more. After a while I received a message from the emperor congratulating me on my success, and inviting me to visit him. To refuse would have been to acknowledge that I was afraid of the emperor. At the same time, my absence from the kingdom would be the signal, I knew, for a revolt. However, I decided to risk the latter danger and go and laugh in the emperor's face. So I set out with a considerable guard. I was received with much pomp and splendor, or at least so it appeared. Really, of course, the whole show was a hollow fraud. The bands which played could only produce a discordant din, the tapestries which adorned the streets were dirty and tattered, the flowers which were strewed in my path were withered, and stank of rottenness, the pretty maids who preceded our procession were rendered hideous by the lines with which cruelty and lust had marked their faces. After meeting the emperor's procession, we went together to witness a gladiatorial show. This finished, we proceeded to the palace, and there a great feast took place. It was the same empty show as all the rest. There was nothing real except what was vile. And how do you like the cares of kingship? Inquired the emperor. Uneasy lies the head, eh? I laughed. It's better than being under your majesty, anyway. Very likely. Still, I fancy you must get a little bit tired of being ever on the watch. I know I do. When I want to change, I take a spell on earth again. It's wonderfully restful and refreshing after the strenuous life one has to lead here. For once my curiosity was greater than my wisdom, and I cried, "But how do you manage to return to earth? I thought once we had lost our astral bodies." "You are still a young man," he replied, "and have much to learn, but I am surprised you do not know that simple fact." He looked at me thoughtfully, and then continued, "If a spirit in hell makes an alliance with a mortal on earth, it is possible for the former to acquire, or at any rate borrow, for a short time, a temporary astral body. At times it is even possible for such a spirit to obtain for a short time a material body. Such men used to be known as wizards, and the women as witches, and the spirits they invoked were always regarded as devils. Of course, many of them were elementals, and a few may have been devils proper. But most of them were just human spirits, and not always bad ones either. Of course it's a risky business playing about with sorcerers. They always try to reduce the spirit in partnership with them to the position of their abject slave. Their wills, of course, are strong, and if the spirit be some rather weak, vicious fool, they can reduce him to a position of absolute subservience, at any rate for a time. But how can they enforce their commands? I cried. By the same methods by which you and I enforce ours, by the mere force of their wills. Just as we can inflict any kind of pain we choose on our subjects, so can these wizards on their spirit slaves. But, of course, with iron wills such as we have, the end always is that we can dominate the wizard and make him our slave. Then, indeed, for a short time, we can have a glorious time. He rose. Let us now go and witness the play which is to be performed in the private theatre, and he referred no more to the subject of magic. But what had been said made a profound impression upon my mind. I was so struck with the idea that I failed to see the danger lurking in it. I have no doubt that the Emperor raised the subject with the object of luring me into this danger, but I did not perceive it. I have often wondered how it was that I did not perceive it. It may have been that the Emperor really had a stronger will than I, and so was able by a very strong exercise of that will to prevent me seeing what was passing in his innermost mind. It may have been, however, that I was so struck with the idea that I never strove to get to the bottom of it and find out what his real object was. Of course, I did not imagine for one moment that he made the suggestion with any other object than that of doing me harm. I thought he foresaw that if I left my dominion to go playing tricks on the earth, I should at once be deposed. This, indeed, I knew quite well would be the case, but I also felt certain I should find no difficulty in throwing out the usurper when I returned. In reality, he knew this too, but he also knew that after a time the effect of this new sin would be to render it impossible for me to return even to that division of hell. I should, in fact, be compelled to fall still lower. Thus he hoped to be rid of me. I did not know this and, being anxious to try the new experience for several reasons, determined to do so. My reasons were, firstly, that I wanted some rest, or at any rate change, from ever standing on guard in hell. Secondly, it would be a new experience, and therefore of interest in itself. Thirdly, the possibility of seeing the earth again filled me with a new sensation, which I can only compare with what a boy feels when he is homesick. I returned soon after to Paris of the Revolution, and of course found civil war in progress. One section had liberated Danton and placed him on the throne. I soon dealt with the matter, and Danton and the other ringleaders returned to the torture chambers. Chapter 13. The Isser and the Wizard. Then I set myself to find a man who, on earth, has been a sorcerer. I discovered a good many, more than I expected, but most of them had only played at the game. The reason, of course, was that those who had really obtained any considerable knowledge in the subject had, on death, fallen even lower in hell than we were. I found one man, however, who had been associated with a far abler man who had fallen lower. The man in my dominion told me all he had learnt from the other, though he had not dared to practice it, and I soon discovered how to get in touch with a magician on earth. This student of the occult was a German, and lived in Prague, or, rather, on the threshold of that city. He knew a lot about magic, and had already discovered how to raise and control the spirits of the dead, in plain English, weak-willed spirits of the astral plane. He could also do something with the elementals. He was now working to raise a real devil from hell, and it was I that answered his invocation. I had set the old magician who was in hell to work before me, in spite of his prayers, for he was afraid. As his incantations rose, they came in contact with those from the man on earth. This stream of incantation soon made itself plain to me, and I was thus informed that there was one on earth who wanted such as I. Voluntarily I stepped into the stream of invocation, and joined my will to theirs. At once I seemed to be drawn through space, and found myself before him. The student of the occult, as he called himself, was standing in the middle of his magic circle, within which were two triangles forming a six-pointed star. All around it were pentagons and a whole host of other mystic signs. A brazier burnt in the room, and from it rose a heavy perfume which filled the room with smoke. The room itself was perfectly dark, and appeared to be a cellar with walls of stone, and floor of the same material. There were some cases with mummies along one side of the wall, and a few articles of furniture, but the larger part of the room was completely bare. Now, though I could see him, he as yet could not see me, and continued his incantations. I began to will that he should see me, and then I perceived lying outside the circle, and at some little distance from it, a woman.